Let's get started. Just one brief announcement. Let's get started. One of the readings for next week, it's actually an article by myself. I forgot to put in the packet. I don't know how it got out of the packet. I had meant to give you a freebie copy of it today. It'll either be handed out Tuesday or I'll put it on the electronic, and I'll send out a notice letting you know what I'm going to do on it. It's just a couple pages, so it won't be difficult to read it between Tuesday and Thursday of next week. Any other announcements, Greg? We're all set.
If you haven't met with one of us, just check your paper copy. Make sure you do that.
Yeah, you do need to check out your term paper topic. Okay, let's get started. One of the writers who has influenced me a great deal in environmental ethics is the English professor Wendell Berry. Some of you know one or the other of his writings. He's written a great deal about land, about our relation to the land. His book, The Unsettling of America, has some superb material, including his chapter on the body and the earth. And one of Berry's theses that he presents and argues for in a number of his books is that if we are not, as human beings, faithful to our children, our friends, our wives, our husbands, our parents, why would we think we would be faithful to the land? If we break promises, marital vows, if we do not keep commitments to our children and others, why in the world would we think that we would be faithful to the land? And I think that's an extraordinarily good question. And Berry looks at it very much within the context of the hyper-individualism in America, and how from a very early age we are taught to put ourselves as number one and in some cases take our promises very lightly. In my lecture this morning, that will be one of the assumptions that I will make, is that if we are not faithful to our spouses, our children, our parents, our friends, it probably is fairly unlikely we will be all that faithful to the land, to nature, to animals, and so on. The other assumption I make is that even in a very wealthy society such as our own, resources are limited. And that if you spend too much money, too many of your resources, solving social pathology, solving problems that we encounter as a society, for example, the huge number of young men and increasingly the large number of women in prison, one of the largest prison populations per capita of any nation in the world. Or if you have other social pathologies, whether drug use or whatever, that are absorbing huge amounts of your resources, there will be that much less to devote to resolving long-term and short-term environmental problems. And the third assumption I make, which is probably fairly obvious, particularly for those of you who study ecology and who are interested in natural resources issues, is that everything is related to everything else. That it's very hard to resolve most social problems in isolation from what is going on in the broader context. So within the framework of those assumptions, I want to lecture this morning on the subject of fatherlessness. I want to suggest that our lack of faith to our children, our putting our own self-interest in so many cases above the interests of our children, in terms of the fact that so many of our children grow up without fathers being actively involved in their upbringing, may constitute one of the most serious social problems we face that has in turn very serious implications for how we deal with particular issues such as our relation to the environment. I draw very heavily from the sociologist David Blankenhorn and his book Fatherless America. This is an extraordinary book. I first read it 5 or 6 years ago or so, and it made a great impact on my thinking. It was published in 1995, and for the last 4 or 5 years, I've actually spoken on this subject of fatherlessness in this course. Again, my assumption of social ecology is that as in biological systems, so in social systems, it is never possible to do just one thing at a time, and that even wealthy nations have limited resources. Where we are today in terms of fatherhood and fatherlessness is reflected even in our children's storybooks. One book says there are different kinds of daddies, and sometimes a daddy goes away like yours did. He may not see his children at all. Blankenhorn refers to this on page 10 of his book. He notes that our story in America today is that, quote, of an increasingly fatherless society. He adds, quote, the moral of this new narrative is that fathers at bottom are unnecessary. Throughout the 18th century, and I found this extraordinarily interesting when I first read this, child-rearing manuals were generally addressed to fathers, not mothers. Until the early 19th century, in almost all cases of divorce, it was established practice to award the custody of children to fathers. I'm not arguing that this was better or worse. I'm just noting the social changes that have taken place. Blankenhorn notes that in addition to this, throughout this period, fathers, not mothers, were the chief correspondents with children who lived away from home. I'd like to touch, as Blankenhorn does, on concepts of masculinity. Daniel Yankelevich, the pollster, notes that until the late 1960s, being a real man meant being a good provider for the family. This was just the conventional wisdom. Being a real man was being a good provider for one's family. No other conception of what it meant to be a real man came even close. Concepts of sexual potency or physical strength or strength of character, manliness, or even being handy around the house were relegated to the bottom of the list of traits associated with masculinity. By the late 1970s, however, the definition of a real man as a good provider has slipped from its number one spot, 86% in 1968, to the number three position at 67%, and it has continued to erode steadily since then. Blankenhorn writes, in sum, over the past 200 years, fatherhood has lost in full or in part each of its four traditional roles: irreplaceable caregiver, moral educator, head of family, and family breadwinner. And he notes that the street culture of our inner cities, he writes this, he says, men's glorification of casual and even predatory sex, completely divorced from responsible fatherhood, has become in many ways the rule of the day. Sociologist Elijah Anderson says that this has become the sex code of young minority males in America and in the inner cities generally among young males. Blankenhorn comments on the subject of culture and fatherhood. And he writes that men, more than women, are culture made. These are very controversial ideas, I realize, and some of these are ideas that you likely haven't heard much in classes at Cornell, but I think they're very challenging. He says fatherhood in particular is what the novelist Herbert Gold calls a metaphysical idea, an imperfect cultural improvisation designed not to express maleness but to socialize it. It derives less from sexual embodiment than from a social imperative, the need to obligate men to their offspring. Fatherhood involves the socialization, the attempt to help men see that they need to be obligated to their offspring. Blankenhorn just gives all kinds of interesting data. I won't take the time to go through this, but it shows that fewer and fewer children over the past three or four decades, although there is some slight turnaround in recent years, fewer and fewer children live out their childhood with their biological fathers. It shows the huge rise of divorce, the rise of what Blankenhorn calls volitional fatherlessness. He points out that historically, the principal cause of fatherlessness was paternal death. He says that by the time they turned 15, about 15% of all American children born in 1870 had experienced the death of their fathers. Only slightly more than half reached age 15 with both parents still alive. This is an entirely different world medically and in terms of various epidemics that people faced and so on. At the turn of the century, the past century, middle-aged widowed men outnumbered middle-aged divorced men by more than 20-1. By 1992, only about 5% of all female-headed households with children had experienced the death of the father. About 37% had experienced parental divorce, and in 36% of these homes, the parents had never married. For the first time in the nation's history, millions of men today are voluntarily abdicating their fatherhood. Blankenhorn notes that though paternal death and paternal abandonment are frequently treated as sociological equivalents, these two phenomena could hardly be more different in their impact upon children and upon the larger society. To put it simply, he writes, quote, "Death puts an end to fathers. Abandonment puts an end to fatherhood. Death puts an end to fathers. Abandonment puts an end to fatherhood." He continues, he says, "Yet among social scientists who study fatherhood, the equivalency argument is quite popular. Alvin Shore and Phyllis Moen, for example, seek to disprove the notion that contemporary father absence is unique and deviant. Historian Tamara Harivan, in testimony before a congressional committee, states, quote, "In fact, divorce now has a similar effect on family disruption that death once had." Blankenhorn totally disagrees. He argues that the social science evidence just shows this to be a really superficial, unrealistic comment. He calls this thesis a sophism. He says, like all sophisms, it depends on a superficial correctness of form to disguise an invalid assertion. He writes, he says, "The equivalence is only formal. Where it counts, death and abandonment are much closer to opposites." They're not equivalent. They're much closer to opposites. Incidentally, I might add as a personal note, one of the reasons that this topic is so important to me is that I went through an unwanted, unexpected divorce when my kids were only 3 and 5. My wife met up with some radical feminists who persuaded her that marriage was oppressive and so on. And I've seen some of the effects firsthand that this has had on the children. It was worse for my son during the early years, worse for my daughter after she married. Sociologists often refer to, and psychologists, to the sleeper effect that divorce has in women as over against the earlier effects that are more typical in boys. And so part of my interest in this is, and I'll have a little truth in advertising, is that it's a topic that's been of great existential concern to me and a topic where I've had a chance to see some of this working itself out in my children and a topic about which I've read very, very extensively. I also had background in this. My PhD at Harvard was in male-female differences and how these were used to structure reality in classical literature. And then I worked for some years in the Harvard Project on Religion and Mental Health, where we dealt with some of these problems, too. So it's a long-standing concern, and it's that background which I bring to this. Blankenhorn notes that when a father dies, a child grieves. I have lost someone I love. When a father leaves, the child feels anxiety and self-blame. What did I do wrong? Why doesn't my father love me? Death is final. He won't come back. Abandonment is indeterminate. What would make him come back? What could I do that might change the situation? When a father dies, Blankenhorn writes, his fatherhood lives on inside the head and heart of his child. In this sense, the child is still fathered. When a father leaves, his fatherhood leaves with him to wither away. The child is unfathered. When a father dies, the mother typically sustains his fatherhood by keeping his memory alive. When a father leaves, the mother typically diminishes his fatherhood by either forgetting him or keeping her resentments alive. Blankenhorn notes further, he says, death kills men but sustains fatherhood. Abandonment sustains men but kills fatherhood. Death is more personally final, but departure is more culturally lethal. A new heading, The Importance of Fatherhood. I'm taking some of these directly out of Blankenhorn's book. Fatherhood, notes David Blankenhorn, is a social role that obligates men to their biological offspring. For two reasons, it is society's most important role for men. First, he notes fatherhood, more than any other male activity, helps men to become good men, more likely to obey the law, to be good citizens, and to think about the needs of others. And he just presents enormous sociological data that bears this out. Put more abstractly, fatherhood bends maleness, in particular male aggression, toward pro-social purposes. Second, fatherhood privileges children. First, it provides a father's physical protection. Second, it provides children with a father's money and material possessions. Third, and probably most significant, and I quote, it provides children with what might be termed paternal cultural transmission, a father's distinctive capacity to contribute to the identity, character, and competence of his children. Fourth, and most obviously, Blankenhorn notes, paternal investment provides children with a day-to-day nurturing feeding that provides children with a day-to-day nurturing, feeding them, playing with them, telling them a story that they need and want from both of their parents. New topic, youth violence. David Blankenhorn refers to a Carnegie Corporation report that lists causes of youth violence, poverty, drugs and alcohol, availability of guns, short school days, lack of social skills, and so forth. Also, the American Psychological Association's Commission on Youth and Violence gives similar reasons for youth violence. Blankenhorn comments as follows. He says, quote, yet the single most obvious factor, the one moreover most likely to produce the other factors, is conspicuously absent from these reports and recommendations and from countless others like them, namely fatherlessness. Blankenhorn claims that, quote, our society remains curiously reluctant to name this problem. In fact, many analysts come very close to blaming our problems with youth violence on traditional norms of fatherhood. Patriarchy, the male mystique, toughness, dominance, repression of empathy, competitiveness, and so forth. Let me just read a few words here from the early part of the book. Well, let me skip that. I'm going to run out of time if I read too much of this, and I want to save some time for discussion. Fatherhood and crime. Blankenhorn writes this. He says there are exceptions, of course, but here is the rule. Boys raised by traditionally masculine fathers generally do not commit crimes. Fatherless boys commit crimes. Now, those are broad generalizations, but he presents enormous data that backs that up. Shannon, question?
I want to hear what he meant by traditionally masculine.
I think he means the what he's been talking about earlier, and I'll say a little more about this. Father is a protector of the family, is provider for the needs of the family. The father is the one who is committed to the well-being of his children and so on. Not the... the androgynous unisex type of concept. His argument is that the psychological and sociological evidence is that children are harmed greatly when we move towards this androgynous concept of towards the flattening of sexual differences. So that's basically what he means. I'll say just a little more about that as I go further. That's an astounding statement, and if it's right, it's the kind of thing that we ought to be thinking a lot about. Says there are exceptions, of course, but here is the rule. Boys raised by traditionally masculine fathers generally do not commit crimes. Fatherless boys commit crimes. The process, he talks about the process by which boys separate from their mothers. That is somewhere between 1 and 3. The boy needs psychologically to move away from his mother and have his father become his primary role model. And he says the father is simply irreplaceable in this process. He says when this process of male identity does not succeed, when the boy cannot separate from the mother, cannot become the son of his father, one main result in clinical terms is rage. Rage against the mother, against women, against society. It is a deeply misogynist rage, vividly expressed, for example, in contemporary rap music with titles such as Beat That Bitch with a Bat, and he gives others that I won't repeat. He says if we want to learn the identity of the rapist, the hater of women, the occupant of jail cells, we do not need to look first to boys with traditionally masculine fathers. We look first to boys with no fathers. The weight of evidence in the social sciences, he says, points increasingly to the fact and supports the conclusion that fatherlessness is a primary generator of violence among young men. He notes that according to a 1990 study, commissioned by the Progressive Policy Institute, the, quote, relationship between crime and one-parent families is so strong that controlling for family configuration erases the relationship between race and crime and between low income and crime. That is, if you control for fatherlessness, the hugely greater number of crimes per person committed by blacks, for instance, than whites, in some cases 6 or 8 times the number, if you control for fatherlessness, that virtually disappears. 68% of all black children in America are born outside of marriage, and it's having a devastating effect, in Blankenhorn's view and in my view, on what is happening, but this is a subject not much talked about by people who work in these fields. The whole thing continues to be blamed on racism and poverty and education and so on. But the social science data here is just astounding. Let me read that again. 1990 study commissioned by the Progressive Policy Institute noted that the relationship between crime and one-parent families is so strong that controlling for family configuration erases the relationship between race and crime and between low income and crime. The conclusion shows up time and again in the literature. Put simply, Blankenhorn concludes, he says we have too many boys with guns, primarily because we have too few fathers. If we want fewer of the former, we must have more of the latter. There is little evidence to suggest that any other strategy will work. Another topic, domestic violence against women. And I'll save time for discussion because this is a very controversial topic to some degree. Feminists have attributed domestic crime against women to marriage and to traditional views of masculinity, male marital privilege, and what it means to be a husband. But if this is so, then why hasn't domestic violence against women declined as marriage has declined? Unfortunately, Blankenhorn notes just the opposite has happened. As more women are living apart from husbands and fathers, more women are being battered by men. He notes, he says, in all societies, the male's primary biological offspring and the mother of his offspring emerge as the primary others on whose behalf he deploys and in doing so socializes his tendency towards aggression and adversative relationships. Ong, Daly, and Wilson report, quote, that male violence is restrained principally by paternal involvement in children, achieved through a reproductive alliance with the mother, in short, through married fatherhood. Blankenhorn continues. He says that the practice of paternal involvement by reapportioning male reproductive effort away from mating competition tends to reduce both the fitness prize for high rank and the risk of total reproductive failure. Biparental care for the young thus softens male-male conflict and selects for less dangerous competitive tactics. Violence against an unmarried woman living with a man is 3 to 4 times more likely than violence against a woman by her husband, except in the very brief period following a divorce, where that peaks for a brief time. Sexual abuse of children. Blankenhorn compares child abuse by biological fathers, by stepfathers, and by live-in boyfriends. He writes this. He says, yes, some, too many, married fathers molest their children. But the weight of evidence is clear. What magnifies the risk of sexual abuse abuse is not the presence of a married father, but his absence. More specifically, the escalating risk of childhood sexual abuse in our society stems primarily from the growing absence of married fathers and the growing presence of stepfathers, boyfriends, and other unrelated or transient males. He notes that the growing prevalence of boyfriends and play husbands, in quotes, in households with children poses a direct threat to children's physical and sexual safety. Fatherless and poverty or economic insecurity. Blankenhorn writes, he says, most scholars now agree that this link between family structure and child poverty is not simply a statistical correlation. It is a causal relationship. Fatherlessness causes child poverty. Adolescent childbearing, I'm just summarizing some of these topics very briefly. The role of the father as a transmitter of culture, Blankenhorn notes, is really important. Biological paternity, quote, helps to produce a child. Fatherhood helps to produce an adult. Fatherlessness, that is the absence of paternal transmission, contributes to a decline of character and competence in children. And I quote him, he says, for boys, the most socially acute manifestation of paternal disinvestment is juvenile violence. For girls, it is juvenile and out-of-wedlock childbearing. One primary result of growing fatherlessness is more boys with guns. Another is more girls with babies. He says that many studies confirm that girls who grow up without fathers are at much greater risk for early sexual activity, adolescent childbearing, divorce, and lack of sexual confidence and orgasmic satisfaction. He says father absence, not money absence, is, in his view, the core issue. Of the young women in the California Children of Divorce study, Judith Wallerstein writes this. She says many of the young women who had done well during their early adolescent years experienced a, quote, sleeper effect as they moved into late adolescence and became very frightened of failure. Almost all confronted issues of love, commitment, and marriage with anxiety, sometimes with very great concern about betrayal, abandonment, and not being loved. In response to this, many of the young women and some of the young men appeared counterphobically to have thrown themselves into short-lived sexual relationships. Blankenhorn concludes, he says, when the soldier father went off to war, and even when he died in combat overseas, much of his fatherhood remained behind, sustained by memory in the lives of his children. Today's fatherlessness leaves very little behind. The 1940s child could say, my father had to leave for a while to do something important. The 1990s child must say, my father left me permanently because he wanted to. There's a very important chapter on the stepfather and the nearby guy, the live-in boyfriend and so on. Blankenhorn notes, he says in 1963, he comments on the Walt Disney picture when they released the film The Incredible Journey. Some of you may have seen the film, the story of three adorable pets, two dogs and a cat, who became separated from the family that loves them, but then managed against all the odds to find their way home again. 30 years later, in 1993, Disney issued a remake of the film. The 1993 film differs from the original in one basic respect. In 1993, the struggle of the three pets to go home to the children is echoed by a parallel struggle of the three children to go home to their new life with a stepfather, not a real father, and so on. Let me just read a few of his comments on this. He says, but over the next several weeks, amazing things happen. The three pets, showing great courage and faith, manage to find their way home to the children who love them. At the same time, the three children, settling into their new life, lovingly embrace Bob as their father, the new man. The key scene, only moments before the missing pets reappear, is when Peter first calls his new stepfather Dad, and the ending is a happy one, and so on. What Blankenhorn points out is that usually things don't work out that well, that the presence, the absence of the real father has lasting negative results for children. Regarding such research, Blankenhorn writes, all these ideas reflect less the actual circumstances of children than the wishful thinking of adults. What he points out is that our divorce culture today has essentially been a kind of ego-centeredness gone crazy. It's been adults who basically say our children are not really important. And they say this in order to justify basically abandoning their children in many cases, or in other cases, men impregnating women and taking no responsibility at all for the welfare of the children. And what Blankenhorn is basically saying is this a reasonable way, a fair way, a just way to treat children? What about this astounding array of negative results? He proposes some solutions, and I'll just touch on a few of these. Some of them are additions of my own. I think there's a powerful social need today to re-stigmatize the fathering of children outside of marriage. I think it has to be one of the most unjust, callous, cruel things that men and women do is to father children and then to bear children, to let oneself as a woman be in that position outside of marriage, where the child has huge disadvantages right from the start. I can't think of anything more tragic and more pathetic of all these stories of movie stars and others who don't want a man around, so get artificially impregnated or a one-night stand with a man because they want a baby as a kind of pet, and then go off and raise the child alone. I think that has to be one of the cruelest and most discriminatory and unjust aspects of our society today, and I think it's having huge effects on the total social fabric. We need to re-stigmatize the fathering of children outside of a marriage. It's a stupid, irresponsible, unjust thing to do, and men who do that are jerks, and the women who permit it are also not very bright, in my view. We need to start talking strong language in the same way that we've used strong language about racism and sexism and so on. I think, secondly, we need to hold the media to more accurate coverage of what is actually happening. The media have not given us the facts on a lot of these issues. They've been ideologically driven. They've withheld a lot of the facts. They simply are not sharing them. Thirdly, there needs to be more genuine diversity in colleges and universities and in departments that deal with issues like this. I've said it before. I will say it sadly again. What happens at Cornell is disgraceful. What happens in human ecology and some of our departments is not academically respectable, in my judgment. It's ideologically driven to an amazing degree. Students simply are not being exposed to a reasonable diversity of ideas on many of these controversial issues. This becomes acutely unreasonable and unfair in tax-supported colleges. To have to pay tax dollars to support the kind of propaganda that takes place on some of these issues, I find really, really astounding. I think, fourthly, we need to change our tax codes. I think we need to move more in the direction that Europe has done in some cases. There need to be child allowances so that mothers or fathers who want to stay home and raise their children will have the financial means to do this or be more nearly able to do it, and that this kind of support ought to have some relation to income. Children need their parents more than the economy needs extra workers. And I think, fifth, we need to rethink the meaning of marriage. Wendell Berry, in his book Sex, Economy, Freedom, and the Community, has some wonderful things to say on this topic. He says, as soon as the parties to a marriage or a friendship begin to require strict justice of each other, then that marriage or friendship begins to be destroyed. For there is no way to adjudicate the competing claims of a personal quarrel. And so these relationships do not dissolve into litigation, really. They dissolve into a feud, an endless exchange of accusations and retributions. If the two parties have not the grace to forgive the inevitable offenses of close connection, that's a wonderful expression, the grace to forgive the inevitable offenses of close connection, the next best thing is separation and silence. But why should separation have come to be the virtually conventional outcome of close relationships in our society? The proper question, perhaps, is not why we have so much divorce, but why we are so unforgiving. The answer, perhaps, is that though we still recognize the feeling of love, we have forgotten how to practice love when we don't feel it. It's become simply an emotion, not also an act of the will. Stanley Hauerwas, in one of his writings, has this wonderful comment. He says, the longer he lives, the more convinced he is that biblical religion teaches us that we ought to love one another, even if we're married. And it's interesting when I quote this because most kids your age don't smile much. If I tell that same line to people 45 and older, people really laugh because they understand it. They understand that the whole silly idea that marriage is based on love is ridiculous. It is not love that sustains a marriage. It is the marriage that provides the framework for love to flourish and for people to learn to sustain and encourage each other, to forgive each other, and so on. But it's very interesting when I quote that line because people your age don't laugh much. But people who have lived through it, I could see a few of you who are slightly older smiling in the back with some genuine understanding. Okay, this is a controversial subject. I raise it because I think that the social fabric is one social fabric, and we cannot ignore problems of this sort if we hope to take proper care of the natural environment around us. Who has some comments or questions? I'd love to know what you're thinking. Yes. I think in many cases that can work well. I think that has to be negotiated in the individual family. My sense is that for very young children, it's not a good idea. I think even the growing evidence that, for instance, breastfeeding for up to a minimum of 6 or 8 months has even effects on IQ and general health that are very, very strong. That's something that I, as a man, can't do. And I think evolutionary-wise, I think it's clear that women have evolved with the kinds of sensitivities and so on which on average suit them better to nurture young children than is the case with men. And these are very complex issues because I think that can be different in individual cases. And I think we've lived through a period where society has greatly downplayed and denigrated the role of nurturing children, so that many women feel they'll always be second or third class citizens if they take out years to nurture their children. And also because of divorce. If a woman spends 10 or 15 years, 20 years raising children, and then the husband, when he gets to be about 45, drops the wife, and for a 25-year-old, that's not a very good deal for the woman if she's not professionally prepared and so on. So those two go together. As you strengthen marriage, I think more women will be honest and say they would enjoy raising children. I find many women, as I talk with them, that they really would like to do that, but they're frightened that if they do it, their husband will later leave them and they won't have a job or a profession and so on. It's a tough issue. Yeah. Yes?
You talked about the data showing conclusively that children who are poor, who don't have father figures, are worse off. Is there any data or indication about children who are in homes where there's a father figure but the father is not married to the woman?
I think there is data, and I think, as I recall it, and this is somewhat tentative, the children, usually it's not as good a deal for children for a number of reasons, one of which those relationships usually are more temporary. And the chance of the father leaving then is much greater. But there are also questions of legitimacy in the eyes of the child. The child, as he gets a little older, wonders, how come my dad didn't care enough to marry? And I don't know that data really, really well, so I'll have to plead some ignorance on that. It may even be some of that in the Blankenhorn book, but I didn't get a chance to reread the whole book last night. Edwina?
With our generation, a large portion of people do not have fathers, as they were growing up. So what steps could we take to be a better father in the generation when we have children?
Boy, it's a really tough question, and I'm wrestling this with this with my own kids, and so on. Again, I don't know exactly how to answer that because I think in some ways we have to see the larger situation change as well as the individual situation, as long as we have a society that so glorifies male violence and so glorifies, not glorifies, but is so promiscuously tolerant of divorce and of men who never show up, it's going to be very, very hard. I think the best thing for individuals in this case is to work with pastors and rabbis and counselors and people that help them individually work through some of the anxieties and fears that may be residuals from divorce. And those are not easy assignments. It's a tough issue. Shannon, and then here.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, clearly.
My cousin, her father left them just after she was born, and now her stepfather she calls daddy.
Right. Obviously, a stepfather can do a wonderful job, and even in cases where there's not a stepfather, men in the church or the local community can step in and be helpful in various ways. So it isn't either the ideal or nothing. There are all kinds of intermediate steps where those of us who are concerned ought to be walking alongside of these single mothers with the children and so on, and trying to step in and be helpful. And my wife and I, for instance, have tried to do this in some ways, and I know others who are doing this. So sure, we really need to work on those issues, but I think part of the issue is that if you deny, as is so common among the academic elites and so on, that there's even a problem, then it's very, very hard to deal with the issue. If you deny all of the social science data of the kind I've quoted, and if you make these ridiculous statements that children are just as well off with a single parent, or I think today the issue is coming up, should gay couples be able to adopt children, and I think it's an outrage. I think that's a hugely unjust thing towards children, because we have just incredible social science data that children do better with a male and a female role model. And that is simply not possible. But I think what's happening, we have this sort of perpetual adolescence in our society, whereas adults, we think we can do anything we want to if it makes us feel good, or have a child as a pet, you know, the single movie star and so on. That isn't the question. The question is, what does it mean to be faithful to children? And that's the issue that I think we continually need to address again. Question? Yeah? Well, I think one of the effects that he talks about that appears fairly early is women, girls who have not been loved and nurtured and so on by fathers as well as mothers, become desperate in many cases for masculine attention, and become very, very much more vulnerable to early sexual experience and sexual seduction and so on. Then when you get to the time of seriously dating and marriage and so on, there are all kinds of anxieties and so on that, you know, will this happen to me again? Will I also not be able to hold my husband? You know, will my husband abandon me like my father did? And there are just all kinds of situations that put the young woman, in some cases the young married woman, in very, very difficult circumstances. And you know, one would ideally want to avoid that.
Mm-hmm. I have a question about the gay couple adoption. Mm-hmm. What about the fact that there's kids that go through the foster care system and they never get adopted by anybody? I mean, do you think that's better than them not being adopted?
That's a borderline case that I think one might have to look at carefully. There's not a huge number of kids in that category, and I don't know if I have a settled conviction on that. I think the general rule ought to be that wherever possible, a child ought to have the advantage of both a male and female role model, someone who could function like mother and father rather than two people of the same sex. That would be the general rule. Yes?
We've touched upon this that's actually really active in the raising of the children.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about, despite the fact that that child is growing up in a community where you have like your next door neighbor looking out on you while you're playing in the street, do the effects of this type of socialization, can they combat the effects of a problem?
Sure, all of that kind of thing helps. And even when I was young, neighbors looked out more for each other's children than today. All of those things are positive, and we ought to also do those things where fathers aren't around. But all of them are second, third rate. The idea that the family structure is infinitely plastic and that virtually any arrangement works is just mythology. It does not work well for children. And that, I base that judgment not only on the social science research, but also on my own research, where I believe more and more of the really hard scientific results show that on average, men and women are different from each other in various ways. We're not talking about individuals, but overlapping bell curves. And that both of those contribute very important things to the socialization of the child. And that can't as easily be supplied. So when you say it takes a village to raise a child, there is some truth in that, and that's a good thing. But it's much, much better for the child if they'd have the village and the mother and father. That would certainly be a much better way. Pardon?
That's what Clinton said.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a good point. Our time is up. Thank you. Yeah.